This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime obliterated whole families in their homes during its 11-day attack on Gaza in May, some removed entirely from the population registry. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Electronic Intifada. This article is published under the heading Palestine. Families obliterated, lives destroyed. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime obliterated whole families in their homes during its 11-day attack on Gaza in May, some removed entirely from the population registry. Parents and children, cousins and siblings, grandparents, aunts and uncles were killed together when the Zionist regime warplanes bombed residential buildings and private homes without warning the families inside. Killing multiple members of multiple families has become a hallmark of Israeli wars on Gaza and has led to Palestinians there resurrecting some grisly traditions. People in Gaza have been reviving an old tradition in which some families exchange their kids so that, in case some get bombed, the others would live. Twitter user Muhammad Qudai wrote amidst the assault, "My family is spread out over three houses in three different locations, as if they're trying to avert a massacre." Maha Muhammad Abu Hatab was visiting her brother Ala Muhammad Abu Hatab's house for aid on May 15th, when it was hit with three Israeli regime missiles, according to Al Mizan, a human rights group in Gaza. There was no warning. My wife and kids went to share the eight blessings with her brother. They got dressed and went to her brother's house. Innocent children. Muhammad al-Hadidi said of his wife Maha and their children, the attack at 1:30 in the morning killed Maha and her children, as well as Allah's wife and children. Maha was 34. Her children, Sohaib al-Hadidi was 12, Abd al-Rahman 7, and their brother Osma was 5. Their 10-year-old brother Yahya was later also confirmed killed in the attack. Their cousins, Yusuf Abu Hatab 10, and his siblings, 9-year-old Bilal, 7-year-old Maryam, and 5-year-old Yaman, were all killed in the strike. Their mother, Yasmin Muhammad Abu Hatab 30, was also killed. Only Muhammad al-Hadidi's 5-month-old son, Omar, survived the Israeli regime's blast. In the early hours of May 13th, the Zionist regime warplanes dropped 20 missiles on a densely populated neighborhood in Beit Lahia. The blast killed 6 members of the al-Tanani family. Rafat Muhammad Ismail al-Tanani and his wife, Raya Fatih al-Tanani, were killed along with 4 of their children. Ismail 7, Amir 6, Adam 4, and their 2-year-old brother Ahmad were all killed in the attack, according to Defense for Children International Palestine. A 7th member of the family is still missing, DCIP reported. The same blast killed the wife and husband who owned the building where al-Tanani family was renting their home, Abd al-Rahim Muhammad al-Madun, 63, and his wife, Halima Ali Abu Sharah, 66. Stores, lawyers' offices, an education center, and 9 houses were completely destroyed in the Zionist regime's strikes. Nearby streets were also destroyed, along with water pipes and sewer systems, as well as telephone lines and electricity. An Israeli regime missile hit a 2-story residential building in Al-Manar neighborhood in Gaza City on the second day of the Zionist regime's onslaught, killing Eyad Fatih Sharir, 44, and his 40-year-old wife, Layali Taha Sharir. Their 15-year-old daughter, Lina Eyad Sharir, were also killed in the blast. After being hospitalized with severe burns after the strike, their 2-year-old daughter, Mina Yat Sharir, nearly survived the Zionist regime's airstrikes on May 11th. But the toddler died from her wounds a week later on May 18th, joining her parents and sister in death. On May 14th, the Israeli regime's warplanes dropped 2 missiles on agricultural land near a home in Beit Lahia, killing 3 children and their mother, Islam Muhammad al-Attar, 8, his 6-year-old sister, Amira Muhammad al-Attar, and their infant brother, Muhammad Zainuddin Muhammad al-Attar, were all killed in the attack. Their 26-year-old mother, Lamia, was also killed. The family was on the ground floor of their home, according to DCIP, and a concrete pillar fell on them. Their bodies were pulled from under the rubble hours after the attack. Lamia's father, a civil defense officer, told Amnesty International that he arrived at the scene with an ambulance and a rescue team after a relative called and told him of the attack. Hassan al-Attar told Amnesty International, "I went to the 3-story house where 20 people live, and I tried to find someone, but I couldn't. Then the rescue team came to help and eventually found my daughter, a mother of 3, with her children, one of them a baby, under one of the pillars of the house. They were all dead. It seems the rest of the residents managed to escape the bombing and reach the hospital. I was shocked." In the early hours of May 12th, the Zionist regime warplanes fired two missiles at a five-story apartment building in Tal al-Hawa neighborhood in Gaza City, killing at least five Palestinians. Rimsad Kamel Saad, 31, a pregnant mother, was killed alongside her five-year-old son, Zaid Muhammad al-Talbani. Her toddler, Maryam Muhammad al-Talbani's remains were only found the day a ceasefire was declared. The Israeli regime attack on Maryam's home was so huge and violent, and she was so tiny, that it took 9 full days to find her body under the rubble. Miranda Cleland of DCIP wrote on Twitter, "The children's father, Muhammad Odeh al-Talbani, was reported injured. Three others were killed in the same attack, while Abdul Karim Isi, 40, Muhammad Hassan al-Qawaji, 34, and Hala Hussein al-Rafi, who was 13 years old. Iyad Abdul Fattah Salha was home with his wife and toddler one afternoon when an Israeli regime missile struck on May 19th, killing them all. Salha was disabled and used a wheelchair. His wife, Amani Yusuf Imawish, was 8 months pregnant. Their toddler daughter, Nagam Iyad Salha, was killed along with them. It remains unclear whether the missile was fired by an Israeli warplane or a weaponized aerial drone, according to DCIP.
Nguyen Diem, a pro-American, became president of South Vietnam in 1955 and, with the assistance of the U.S., began to arrest anyone suspected of being a member of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition. The U.S. then gradually increased its troop deployment to the country, fearing that communism would soon spread across the region. In 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin incident gave the U.S. government an excuse to justify a war on Vietnam. An intruding U.S. destroyer clashed with North Vietnamese Navy torpedo boats in August of that year. In an ensuing sea battle, one U.S. aircraft and three North Vietnamese torpedo boats were damaged. Also, four North Vietnamese soldiers were killed. As a result, the U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. After a bloody and protracted war, a truce was struck in 1973, ending direct U.S. involvement and completing the evacuation of American forces, which had grown to 500,000. The war claimed the lives of 58,000 Americans and 4 million Vietnamese. It impacted 700,000 American veterans, cost the U.S. more than $100 billion, and tarnished the country's image and morale at home. However, the true narrative behind the Vietnam War was revealed after then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara commissioned a secret history based on classified papers, the Pentagon Papers, in 1967. He formed a research team to assemble and analyze Defense Department decision-making dating back to 1945. An analyst on the research, Daniel Ellsberg, eventually disclosed portions of the report to the New York Times, which was published in 1971. The papers revealed that the U.S. had secretly enlarged the scope of its actions in the Vietnam War, with coastal raids on North Vietnam and Marine Corps attacks, none of which were reported in the mainstream media. The Pentagon Papers are an important record of the United States' first defeat in a war. To this day, the United States' failures in the Vietnam War, as well as its atrocities in terms of civilian casualties and the deployment of chemical weapons, have stained America's reputation at home and abroad. After years of battle and endless resources poured into the U.S. military to win the Battle of Vietnam, the result saw the U.S. lose the war and has since seen it lose many more, all from the same common denominator. Daniel Ellsberg has compared the forever wars with the Vietnam War. He says both conflicts are characterized by lies and deceptions fed to the American people and the rest of the world, about the inflated and false achievements of the wars. America's forever wars have lasted for 2 decades and cost $6.4 trillion, resulting in calls on Washington to reassess its policies, as there are doubts whether the benefits to U.S. security outweigh the costs. The U.S. troops have also conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. The U.S. military has conducted so-called counter-terror activities in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. Moreover, Washington owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all 6 continents. The ongoing war on terror has taken a heavy toll as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and over 335,000 civilians have lost their lives.
Oh, definitely, and they're not gonna learn that lesson as long as the U.S. remains an imperialist country. And the reality is that every war, from Korea to Vietnam, and even if we went back further in history to the wars against the Native Americans, the people are always demonized in the targeted countries. Those are the targets of the war machine. And today we have the same thing going on. Cuba is demonized, Venezuela is demonized, North Korea, Iran.
After spending trillions of dollars and ruining the lives of millions during the forever wars, Washington has failed to win a single war as yet. The Vietnam War and the forever wars share the same characteristics, the lies and deceptions fed to the American people and the rest of the world about the war's exaggerated and false achievements. It seems Washington doesn't want to learn its lesson and stop fighting lost battles. Since 2010, Israel has been linked to at least a dozen of attacks on Iran's nuclear program. These operations were aimed at disrupting Iran's progress in the field of peaceful nuclear technology through acts of sabotage targeting Iran's nuclear facilities and assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Between 2010 and 2012, 4 Iranian scientists, Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Dariush Rezai Nejad, and Mohsen Ahmadi Roshan were assassinated, while another scientist named Fereydoun Abbasi was wounded in an attempted murder. Also, in November 2020, another top Iranian nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was assassinated in a roadside attack. Iran blamed the killing on Israel and condemned it as terrorism. Tehran also slammed world bodies for their silence on the acts of terrorism targeting the Iranian nation and its elite personalities. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv neither confirmed nor denied its involvement in the attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and scientists. However, last week, Israel's Channel 12 aired an eye-opening interview with former Mossad chief Yossi Cohen, who led the spy agency for more than 5 years. Yossi Cohen hinted at Tel Aviv's involvement in 2 explosions over the last year at Natanz nuclear facility, as well as the assassination of a prominent nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He also shamelessly threatened Iranian scientists involved in the country's nuclear program with death. That's while Israel has always pursued a policy of deliberate ambiguity over its nuclear capabilities, as well as the issue of targeted killings and airstrikes. Iran's mission to the United Nations slammed Israeli lawlessness, saying that Cohen's comments reflect Tel Aviv's long-standing strategy of criminal sabotage against Tehran. Cohen's interview is aired as talks to revive Iran's nuclear deal are about to resume amid hints of progress. The Israeli regime has been the nuclear deal's strongest opponent, although the United Nations, the European Union, and others have hailed it as a diplomatic success. Iran has repeatedly complained about Israel's attacks, with Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, warning as recently as Thursday that the incidents not only will be responded to decisively, but also certainly leave no option for Iran but to reconsider its transparency measures and cooperation policy. Qareeb Abadi also slammed IAEA's silence in the face of terrorist attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities and the assassination of scientists. Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of the weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program and assassinated several Iranian nuclear scientists in recent years. However, Iran has rejected all these accusations, as it was among the first nations to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it has been under the most intense scrutiny and inspection by the IAEA than any country in the world. That's why the Israeli regime itself has, under constant U.S. protection, avoided joining the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and is now in possession of hundreds of nuclear warheads and other non-conventional weaponry.
Israel is saying that it claims a right to commit any act of murder or sabotage against Iran that it wishes. But what Israel doesn't realize, and what Israel's American backers don't realize, is that that these kinds of actions virtually force Iran or other such countries to take equivalent measures against Israel and the U.S. So they're opening up a Pandora's box by opening the international scene to all kinds of acts of murder, sabotage, revenge, etc. And every country will claim the right to do so, and they'll cite Israel as an example. So, as I said, Israel is playing with fire here and is going to get burned because equivalent measures will be taken against it.
The revelation of outgoing Israel's spy agency that Israel was behind recent attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and its top scientists shows that it has no respect for the law. That's why Israel has followed a deliberate policy of ambiguity for years. It seems favoritism towards Israel by the International Atomic Energy Agency, as well as Washington's invariable support for the regime, has given it the green light to break international law. Isn't it high time for the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes?
When the novel coronavirus began to spread around the globe in early 2020, many were pinning their hopes on herd immunity as a means to end the pandemic. A slow process in which a majority of the population becomes immune to the disease, making the transmission harder. But scientists began their studies on the contagion from early on to understand the virus and produce a vaccine. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine became the first to obtain the World Health Organization's approval for emergency use, offering the world a glimmer of hope in the fight against the deadly respiratory disease. Months later, however, the world is still struggling with the pandemic and its impact on the lives of its 8 billion inhabitants. While new cases and deaths have sharply fallen in richer nations, poorer countries, including those in Africa, are witnessing soaring infections and fatalities. Many observers, including the WHO, attribute that to vaccine inequity.
6 months since the first vaccines were administered, high-income countries have administered almost 44% of the world's doses. Low-income countries have administered just 0.4%. The most frustrating thing about this statistic is that it hasn't changed in months. Inequitable vaccination is a threat to all nations, not just those with the fewest vaccines.
Well, I think that it's never too late if you're talking about saving lives around the world, but I believe that it's absolutely true that we should have approached this pandemic as a global problem from the very beginning. If all of the countries had teamed together and distributed the vaccines across the globe early on, I think we would have seen much, much less death and devastation due to this pandemic. So, yes, it's wonderful that some countries are stepping up now and offering doses of the vaccine, but absolutely this should have been done, 12, 13, 15 months ago.
human rights groups and charities are calling on the world's richest nations to do more to help bring the pandemic to an end. Ahead of its visit to the United Kingdom to attend the G7 summit, U.S. President Joe Biden unveiled America's plan to help poorer nations fight the COVID-19 outbreak.
The United States will purchase 500 million doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to donate to nearly 100 nations that are in dire need in the fight against this pandemic.
Other G7 nations have also pledged to chip in to meet the group's 1 billion dose target. In the meantime, health and anti-poverty campaigners say while the G7's pledge is a step in the right direction, it falls short of the number of doses needed to win the battle against the pandemic. Charity organization Oxfam said, to end the COVID crisis, the world needs 11 billion doses of vaccines. It also called on the G7 to support a push for a waiver on the intellectual property rights behind the vaccines, a move that would give other nations better access to the much-needed jabs.
I think that the amount of doses being offered are absolutely a drop in the bucket, and we've seen certainly here in the United States that the country was very, very cautious about releasing doses, hoarding doses, really, of the vaccine for a very long time. Partly with a notion of protecting the local residents first before sharing vaccines with the rest of the world. And I do think this is a very short-sighted approach because the vaccine does not know boundaries. The vaccine does not know national borders. And so as we've seen with the way the pandemic spread, you have to vaccinate the entire world in order to protect everyone in the world. So the idea of reserving doses just for your own population, I think, is very, very short-sighted on the part of all of these countries.
According to Johns Hopkins University, over 2.2 billion doses have been administered worldwide as of June 12, 2020. At this rate, several countries are expected to fall short of the WHO's target of inoculating 10% of their population against the infectious disease by September.
The diplomatic relationship between the United States and its geopolitical rival Russia is severely strained. A series of tit-for-tat actions has left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Such actions date back to the 1980s, but they have escalated over the past years. In 2016, America expelled dozens of Russian intelligence operatives. In response, Moscow expelled more than 700 American diplomats the following year. Later, the U.S. ordered the closure of Russian consulates in San Francisco and Seattle. Russia ordered the closure of the U.S. consulate in St. Petersburg in 2018. Earlier this year, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden announced sanctions on Moscow and expelled 10 Russian diplomats. In response, the Russian Federation announced that it was sanctioning several high-ranking U.S. officials and expelling 10 American diplomats. Right now, the U.S. and Russia have withdrawn their ambassadors from their respective capitals. Such tit-for-tat actions have resulted in a dramatic reduction in the diplomatic footprint in Moscow and Washington, making it very difficult to even conduct basic diplomacy. Moscow and Washington have deep differences over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. Observers believe such differences have their roots in the geopolitical rivalry between the two superpowers around the world. Ties between the United States and Russia are once again under the spotlight as the U.S. president and his Russian counterpart are scheduled to meet next week. During their upcoming meeting, the American president is expected to raise very touchy issues with the Russian leader. Those sore points include allegations of Russian interference in American elections and Moscow's involvement in Ukraine, where Russia and the West have been locked in a tug of war for years. This week, Biden had tough words for Russia just days ahead of the high-stakes Geneva meeting. He warned that Moscow faces robust and meaningful consequences if it engages in, quote, harmful activities.
What the United States is trying to do is to act like they are tough for domestic consumption. You know, what goes on between the two leaders, what exactly Biden would be afraid of, we don't know. What worries United States the most is the whole situation with Ukraine, because United States put all their bets and all their sort of cards and all their money into Ukraine.
Before Biden sits down for talks with Putin in Geneva, he is consulting with European leaders at the G7 in Britain and the NATO summit in Brussels. Biden is expected to try to build pressure on the Russian Federation. America views Russia as the second most serious threat after China. While former U.S. President Donald Trump tried to avoid penalizing Russia on the world stage, in his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed new sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden seems intent on taking a tougher line on Moscow. How will Putin react? The Russian leader is known for refusing to back down. The upcoming meeting in Geneva may not produce a breakthrough, but its outcome will probably provide a hint about the future course of relations between the two rivals.
In the limelight.
Tens of thousands of people, including the leaders of the three parties on Spain's right, have rallied in Madrid to protest against the government's deeply divisive moves to pardon the 12 Catalan independence leaders convicted over their parts in the failed secession attempt almost 4 years ago. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Sam Jones. The piece is titled, Spanish Right Rallies Against Plans to Pardon Catalan Separatists. Tens of thousands of people, including the leaders of the three parties on Spain's right, have rallied in Madrid to protest against the government's deeply divisive moves to pardon the 12 Catalan independence leaders convicted over their parts in the failed secession attempt almost 4 years ago. The event on Sunday, 13th of June, held beneath the enormous Spanish flag in the capital's Plaza de Colón, came almost 2.5 years after a similar demonstration against the socialist government's handling of the Catalan independence crisis. The National Police Force said 25,000 people had attended the rally on Sunday, whilst local police put the figure at 126,000. Unlike the last protest, during which the heads of the Conservative People's Party and the center-right Citizens Party posed for controversial photos alongside the leader of the far-right Vox Party, the leaders deliberately kept their distance from one another on Sunday. A recent national opinion poll for El Mundo found that 61% of the public did not agree with the pardons, while 29.5% backed them. The socialist-led coalition government of Pedro Sanchez will have the final say, but Spain's Supreme Court issued a non-binding report opposing the pardons last month, saying the jail sentences of between 9 and 13 years handed to 9 of the 12 independence leaders were appropriate, and noting those convicted had not shown the slightest evidence or faintest hint of contrition. Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has acknowledged that pardons are unpopular with voters, but says they are the best way to end the political standoff and re-establish coexistence. Spanish society needs to move from a bad past to a better future, and that will require magnanimity, the Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said earlier this week. Both his willingness to consider the pardons and his emollient words have been seized on by his opponents, who accuse him of abandoning his previous anti-pardon stance and of selling out to the pro-independence Catalan Republican Left Party, on whom his minority government depends for support in Congress. We ask Pedro Sanchez to respect national unity, the Constitution, the equality of all Spaniards, and the law. The Popular Party leader, Pablo Casado, said before heading to the rally, "We're asking Sanchez not to sell unity and national sovereignty for a handful of votes." Inés Arrimadas, who leads the Citizens Party, said Spaniards wanted justice and democracy. Mr. Sanchez ran in the election saying he wouldn't pardon the coup mongers, and that's why we're here today, to make sure he keeps that promise, she said. He knows Spanish society doesn't want the pardons. Leader of the far-right Vox Party, Santiago Abascal, addressed the lack of another group photo and rallied against what he termed the government's treasonous machinations. "We're back in the Plaza de Colón once more, and we're not afraid of any kind of photo," he said. The picture that shames Spaniards is the one that the national government, being photographed governing and staying in power thanks to all the enemies of Spain, of freedom, and of constitutional order. Santiago Abascal, the leader of the far-right Vox Party, said the pardons were an act of treason against all Spaniards, who have to watch as the politicians who stage a coup against the Constitution are freed by an illegitimate and illegal government order. In an interview published on Sunday, 13th of June, Carmen Calvo, Spain's senior deputy prime minister, said the pardons would be approved soon and insisted the only viable alternative for Catalonia was a political rapprochement and an end to provocations from both the independence movement and the Spanish right. Speaking to La Vanguardia, Carmen Calvo, Spain's senior deputy prime minister, called on the Popular Party to behave responsibly and attacked it for returning to the Plaza de Colón in the company of the far-right Vox Party. "The Popular Party needs to accept its share of responsibility and decide what it's going to contribute," she said. "It is just going to go back to Plaza de Colón with the airs of Francoism? That's a ludicrous and indeed hypocritical answer, given they don't want to be in another photo." The former socialist prime minister, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, also threw his weight behind the pardons, telling the online newspaper eldiario.es and InfoLibre, "Reconciliation, contact, dialogue and forgiveness are the only path to coming together again. This is the way to restore normality and coexistence after all that we've been through." Sunday's rally came as the far-right anti-austerity Podemos Party, the junior party in Pedro Sanchez's coalition, chose Ione Belarra as its new leader. Belarra, who serves as the government's social rights minister, replaces Pablo Iglesias, who retired from Spanish politics last month.
diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Leader's speech in meeting with members of Assembly of Experts. This is part of a speech delivered on August 31, 2006 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with members of the Assembly of Experts.
I should briefly say in this meeting that participation in elections is a public duty. Everyone should feel responsible to fulfill this duty. This is another matter that should receive attention for the sake of preserving the credibility of this assembly. The Assembly of Experts is not a place for pursuing partisan issues and for advocating a specific clique and group. The goal of this assembly and the philosophy for which it has been formed is a completely public and national matter. It is not a place for involving one's partisan motives and political differences. This assembly is beyond these things. Therefore, those who have different political beliefs and opinions can participate in all organizations, including this assembly. But the Assembly of Experts is not a place for implementing these motives and for promoting one's party. These partisan motives should be seriously avoided here. What I can say to you, honorable gentlemen, about the general conditions of the country is that, thankfully, the country is moving forward and making progress in all areas. We should take care not to let some temporary calculations and some short-term and temporary phenomena divert our attention away from long-term outlooks. This should not be the case. We have really moved forward. We have really moved towards the goals of the revolution. In the present time, what is clear and tangible in the country is the acceleration of the fundamental activities of the country. To be fair, current officials are moving towards the necessary tasks that have been planned for the country. They are moving towards these tasks in a rapid way and without wasting opportunities. Their orientations and goals are correct as well. The goal of social justice is one that all of us are after. This goal is the philosophy behind our existence.
The limelight. Before meeting the leaders of the world's major economic powers at the G7 summit in the United Kingdom, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he was concerned that the richest nations have pumped billions of dollars more into fossil fuels than clean energy since the coronavirus pandemic, despite their promises of a green recovery. We now present you an article written by Oliver Millman. The piece is titled Antonio Guterres Under Climate Crisis. We're coming to a point of no return. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Oliver Millman's article. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned wealthy countries risk an unforgivable lost opportunity by not emerging from the COVID-19 pandemic with newly green economies to address the climate crisis. Before meeting the leaders of the world's major economic powers at the G7 summit in Cornwall in the United Kingdom, Antonio Guterres said he was concerned that the richest nations have pumped billions of dollars more into fossil fuels than clean energy since the coronavirus pandemic, despite their promises of a green recovery. Guterres told The Guardian that at the United Nations headquarters in New York, as part of a Covering Climate Now consortium of interviews alongside NBC News and El País, he said, "I'm more than disappointed. I'm worried about the consequences. We need to make sure we reverse the trends, not maintain the trends. It's now clear we're coming to a point of no return." Antonio Guterres added, "To spend these trillions of dollars and not use this occasion to reverse the trends and massively invest in the green economy will be an unforgivable lost opportunity." Recent analysis showed the G7 countries, the United Kingdom, United States, Canada, Italy, France, Germany, and Japan, have committed $189 billion to support oil, coal, and gas, as well as offer financial lifelines to the aviation and automotive sectors since the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic. This is over $40 billion more than has been directed towards renewable energy. Several leaders, including the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, have stressed the need for the climate crisis to be central to the COVID recovery. With various cities around the world ushering in cyclists and pedestrians to streets previously dominated by cars. But while the G7 countries have agreed to stop the international financing of coal, the world's wealthiest nations are pouring billions of dollars into developing gas, another fossil fuel, in the global south at a rate four times that of finance supporting wind or solar projects. According to the International Energy Agency, the IEA, with economies starting to reopen, planet heating emissions are expected to jump by the second biggest annual rise in history in 2021. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he welcomed the G7 commitment, as many countries are still addicted to coal, but that much more needed to be done in what he called a make-or-break year that will be rounded off by crucial United Nations climate talks in Glasgow, Scotland, this November. Gutierrez added, "We need to abolish subsidies to fossil fuel. This is a central question. We have to look at the real costs that exist in the economy, which means a price on carbon. If we do these things, many of the investments made to fossil fuels in the recovery phase will obviously not be profitable. They will be stranded assets with no future." A key priority for the United Nations Secretary General at the G7 summit will be to press leaders on the contentious issue of climate finance. As part of the landmark Paris Climate Accord in 2015, rich countries agreed to provide $100 billion a year to developing countries to help them adapt to the damaging flooding, drought, heat waves and other impacts of the climate crisis. However, this money has never been delivered in full, and Antonio Guterres said it will be impossible to effectively deal with the climate crisis without assistance for poorer countries. He said the G7 countries will need to deliver the money to rebuild trust with developing nations. The United Nations Secretary General said, "The $100 billion is essential. Climate action has until now been centered on mitigation, on reducing emissions. But developing countries have huge problems in adaptation from the existing impacts of climate change." United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres claimed he was hopeful that U.S. President Joe Biden will be able to mobilize other countries to meet commitments on climate aid as the United States continues its reintegration into international climate diplomacy following the presidency of Donald Trump. But Sally Mulhock, the director of the International Center for Climate Change and Development in Bangladesh, said, "The United States has a lot of catching up to do. Joe Biden doesn't get a free pass because it's the United States that caused the damage." Sally Mulhark said, "If you fail to deliver for the rest of the world, that will be our problem and it will come back to bite you." Scientists recently warned that the world could breach, albeit temporarily, the 1.5 degrees Celsius average temperature increase limit set out in the Paris Climate Accord within the next 5 years. However, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, "It's not only possible, it's necessary to strive to avoid global heating above this threshold, beyond which disastrous climate impacts are expected." Guterres said, "We still have time, but we are on the verge," adding, "When you're on the verge of the abyss, you need to make sure your next step is in the right direction." We'll be right back.
with reporters.
On the sidelines of the NATO summit in Brussels, Democrats Abroad Belgium held a rally to coincide with the visit of Joe Biden. We sought their views on current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal, which Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, tried to destroy.
I would actually encourage Biden to make that leap of faith and go ahead and say, listen, we're in, the sanctions are lifted, now it's up to you.
I don't know any more about the outcome than you do, but I'm confident that they're sincere about trying.
I'm crossing my fingers. He's allowed to do at least half of what he's trying to do, because there's a lot of obstruction in the Senate, of course.
Inside the summit, calls were made for the 30 countries in NATO to stand strongly together in order to face down current threats.
Especially at a time when authoritarian regimes like Russia and China challenge the rules-based international order.
Moscow and Beijing reject the criticism, and some analysts argue NATO is merely trying to justify its existence by creating adversaries. Also, there are divisions within NATO itself. For example, Turkey and Germany have important economic ties to Russia and China. Even the UK seems to be trying to tone down NATO HQ rhetoric.
I don't think anybody around the table today wants to descend into a new Cold War with China. I don't think that's where people are, but I think people see, they see challenges.
For his part, Joe Biden had this to say about Vladimir Putin ahead of a meeting with the Russian president on Wednesday.
He's bright, he's tough, and I have found that he is as they say, when he used to play ball, a worthy adversary.
There have not been huge protests to coincide with Biden's visit to Belgium. That's in stark contrast to when Donald Trump was here. Clearly, the optics are different on this occasion, but critics of US foreign policy say fundamentally the same problems still exist. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After more than a decade, Israel has turned the page of Benjamin Netanyahu's rule, ushering in a new era with a new coalition cabinet led by Naftali Bennett, the head of the right-wing Yamina party, and Yair Lapid, the leader of Yesh Atid party. However, the Palestinian leadership remains skeptical, saying it expects no changes in Israeli policy towards Palestinians. It says the only difference that could be seen is that former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will no longer be there. Palestinian officials say they expect the Bennett-Lapid cabinet to be worse than the one it's replacing.
Israel's policies won't change even if a new coalition is taking office. There is no hope for change from the Bennett rule. In my opinion, it's more extreme than the one it's replacing. Bennett is likely to pursue the same right-wing agenda as Netanyahu. And here comes the role of the international community to prevent future aggression and violence against the Palestinians.
Bennett, a former chairman of the Yesha Settlers Council, has long vowed to prevent the establishment of an independent Palestinian state, and he supports the annexation of major parts of the occupied West Bank, as well as expanding settlement construction.